The things we all carry is a podcast about first responders and their stories surrounding trauma on the job. The intention of this podcast is to raise awareness and share meaningful conversation around a subject often viewed as taboo or simply ignored. Be aware this content may be graphic and it is real. It may not be suitable for children or adults triggered by this subject matter.
I was reminded this weekend that this thing we all call healing or life or whatever you want to call it is it's again that word that I've used so many times. It's a roller coaster. Nothing's linear, and you can't take any of it for granted. I woke up Sunday morning, which was Easter, and I knew that I was off. And I mean off in a way that I just couldn't identify right away. I was kind of down. I was kind of blah. I was kind of like, I didn't want to participate in anything. I just kind of wanted to hide out and I guess wallow, for lack of a better word. And I don't like that word, but that's kind of what it was. And it took me a minute to realize what it was. And I wrote about it. So I won't get too in depth about it, but if you guys want to check it out, go check my blog out. It's on Substack. And it's under the things we all carry. And if you don't have the address, I will gladly give it to you. I post about it on Instagram all the time. Well, not all the time. I post about it when I write. But I identified on Sunday that it was the fact that it was Easter. And I know that it's a funny thing to that Easter affects somebody like, well, an atheist like myself. But my mom had a connection to it. So that holiday has a connection to my mom. And, you know, it hit me that, okay, it's another first. And then my birthday is coming up in a couple of days. And so that's going to be another first. And I didn't prep myself for this first very well. And so I'm doing that. I'm not doing that. I'm trying to pay more attention to it. And it's only fair to people around me and people in my life that I do pay more attention to it, because they get the blowback, even if it's, you know, online or in person or whatever it is. People, they do get that blowback. It's not just me that I affect. I affect everybody around me. And that's unfair to everybody, because that's not their fault. It's not their issue. It's my issue. And it's something I need to be mature enough to deal with. As I said, my birthday is coming up and it's this week. And it's one of those that I just don't want to celebrate, but I know I'm going to in some manner, in some form. But I'm also going to take some time that day to acknowledge that, to acknowledge the fact that the one person that's been there for all of them isn't there for this one. And it's not easy. As you can hear in my voice, it's not easy. But Jesus, at least I had this opportunity to celebrate so many of them with her and have her there for so many of them. And I realize I'm lucky for that. I realize that some people don't have that relationship and don't have that connection. And I celebrate what I had with my mom. But I'm also going to mourn the fact that I can't celebrate that with her anymore. So yeah, it's been something that was weighing on my head and, weighing on my mind and in my head. But in a weird way, it didn't connect. I didn't put the dots together and I didn't go, okay, wait a second. Let's take a minute. Think about it. Process kind of some of those feelings. No, I did my typical thing and I let it stew. And God damn it, I got to stop doing that. I have to stop doing that. We all have to stop doing that. And this is where I talk about, you just have to talk. Just fucking talk. It makes such a difference when you talk, you know, get it out. At some point, get it out. And I wasn't able to get it out initially on Sunday to anybody that I could talk to or that I could text or message or whatever. And people did bear the brunt of that. And it kind of continued through the day. Yesterday, I was kind of in a funk and I was beating myself up for not getting certain things done and not following through on something. And it just hit me. That it's like, come on, man, you know what's going on. Work through it. acknowledge it and push forward, but work through it. Still, that's the key. Acknowledge it, talk about it, work through it. And it's just like I say for everything, you know, you have to talk. You have to share what's going on. If not, it's just going to eat at you. And when it eats at you, you just set yourself up for disaster. So here I am on a Tuesday, sitting behind a mic, wondering what I'm going to say, wondering what's in my head. And I had an exchange on Instagram this morning with a firefighter who's also a comedian, and he's from Florida. And it was talking about one of my posts today was about administrations failing firefighters or failing cops or failing paramedics or whoever, in the sense that they don't prepare them for the emotional toll that the traumas you see on the job take on you. And they do take a toll on people. I don't care who you are. You can tell me they don't affect you, and I'm going to call you a liar. You're bullshitting me. They do affect you. You just don't acknowledge it. And when I say the administrations are failing people, what I mean is that they're not preparing you to deal with this. They're not preparing you to process it and move past it before it becomes an issue. And none of that is easy. And you have to admit that these things do take a toll on your employees before you can even give them a tool for a toolbox, that corny ass saying. And so we had an exchange about it, you know, and some of these laws are coming into play, and they're well-intentioned laws where they say, okay, so you have PTSD, we acknowledge that, and now it's a service-connected disability, and you can retire and take a pension because of it. That's fantastic. But what you don't recognize in that is that there's an unintended consequence in that. So now what people are doing is going, you're more resistant to provide services to your people because, well, if you provide services for your people, then you admit that there's a problem. And if once there's a problem and they can get a diagnosis, well, now you have to pay them and you have to give them this pension. And while these laws are well-intentioned and there's so much good behind them, there is that potential to either take advantage of it, because we know human nature, people are going to take advantage of it, just like people take advantage of FMLA. People take advantage of leave donations and they just, instead of getting help, they sit around and get drunk. So there's a potential for people to take advantage of a program like this. But there's also that potential, on the other hand, for municipalities and administrations to say, oh, we don't have a problem. There's no PTSD here. There's no trauma here. Our guys are good, and not acknowledge that there's something going on, because if you acknowledge it, now you have to pay for it, and nobody wants to pay for it. So what do you do? And the exchange I had was, I know that happens, but what I'm saying is, let's nip that shit in the bud as much as we can. So you run a traumatic call. Let's give those tools to deal with it in the moment. So you get done with your call and the adrenaline dump is gone, and now you've got nothing but the visceral memory of what happened in that call. Now, infant CPR, I don't know, a traumatic crash, a death in a fire, whatever it is, you've got this very immediate, like I said, visceral memory or feeling of the call. Let's get that processed. And we can either pay a little up front and process it and get people the help they need immediately, or you can pay more on the back end when they are diagnosed with PTSD. And what I mean by pay a little up front is you can bring in a crew to take their place. So they run a very traumatic call, and you know the best thing for a crew at that moment is REM sleep. You know, is a healthy sleep cycle. Send them home, get them sleep, let them get some counseling, let them get some therapies, let them process it. Bring in a crew on overtime or to backfill or whatever it is to take their place, run their calls, and let this crew process what just happened to them. That's one idea. There are multiple ideas you could use. you know, this is just me kind of spitballing off the top of my head. I'm sure we could come up with something else. Sure, SISM might work if it's done properly. Peer support might work if you've garnered the, I don't know, the clout as a peer support program. Some peer support programs just don't work because the people in the peer support program themselves don't know what they're doing. So let's get these people to help when the call happens so they don't start to build up this cache of the complex PTSD or this, you know, just that, a cache of complex that would lead to PTSD, complex PTSD, which is the repetitiveness of these calls building on top of each other. Let's defeat that before we get to a diagnosis. And then you're looking at saving money in the long run. But in this episode today, we talk about it. You know, you're told to just deal with it. Okay, that was a shitty call. And most people don't run that in their lifetime. Sorry you had to do that. Deal with it, get over it. Come on, let's go run another one. That's not the way to do it, but that's still being done today. We need to change that. We need to get the services to our first responders as these calls come through, not wait. There are a few people that I've spoken to that are in positions to make some change, and they have an idea of it, and they're trying to implement it at maybe like a station level or a battalion level. But department wide I haven't seen it happen yet. And if you have examples, I would love to hear them, but I haven't seen it happen yet. So my point with all of that was let's take care of our people as soon as we can when these calls happen. And you don't have to worry so much about what you're going to pay on the back end of a 20, 25 year career. Let's pay a little bit up front and reap the benefits and the dividends from it instead of waiting to try and say, oh, well, yeah, we'll give them a little money because now they have PTSD. Some people are going to get it. Some people are going to be diagnosed with it, and it's going to be very legit, and it's a disability, and they should honor that. But I think that we can work with some of these people beforehand, before we get to that point, and have a lengthy and healthy career. And, you know, I don't know, I forgot what episode it was, but Joey from Conscious Movements came on, and he was saying that same thing. If he had gotten some services when he needed it, he would still be a firefighter or medic today. But he wasn't given the opportunity to take those services when he needed it. And so we need to work on that end more than anything. We need to work on that more immediate service and recognition that a call was traumatic or eventful or whatever you want to call it. Get the services that people need immediately. Get them on a road or a path to some sort of recovery as soon as possible, and try to prevent this need for an intervention down the road or a diagnosis down the road, which might lead to an early retirement. You know, we just need to do right by our people. Welcome to episode 113 of The Things We All Carry. Today I have Kyler. Kyler's out of Central Utah, and he's an advanced EMT. He runs with a volunteer ambulance service and an interfacility transport service, and he's been a volunteer firefighter for 7 years now. Kyler reached out to me on Instagram, and he said that he'd been listening for a while, and that he would like to be considered because of his story. And then he kind of got into a story a little bit, and I won't go too far in depth, but I'll just say that he's just at the beginning of a mental health journey for some of the trauma he's experienced. And that trauma started with, and I'll even say before that, because Kyler was a part of the Church of Latter-day Saints in Utah, and he decided to step away from the church and kind of went away from what was expected of him. So I'm going to hazard a guess to say that some of that started in that process. But then at 18, he got a call that his mom had committed suicide. And the loss of a parent is devastating, is traumatic as hell. But the sudden loss in such a manner is even more jarring, I would believe. And Kyler and I talk a little bit about that and how he's started to process some of it. But on top of that, what he then does is after he gets out of EMT school is he he ends up seeing multiple suicides on the job. He's told when the first one happens, oh, that's a once in a career kind of call. Well, we all know that suicides aren't a once in a career kind of call. And he sees multiple suicides in some various manners. And he comes to a realization, and we'll talk about it on the show. He comes to a realization about what was going on with some of these people that commit suicide. And I think that that's very helpful for him when he does come to this realization. You know, he gets to a spot where he gets overwhelmed with anxiety and he can't take a break. He can't sit down and relax, because once he sits and relaxes, his heart races. Anxiety kicks into high gear. And so he's got to find a way to combat that and to get past that. And he does, and we'll talk about it in the show. But this is an interesting one, because how many of us sat in our EMS class or EMT school and they said, they asked you, what kind of a call do you not want to run? And everybody has an idea. Well, for Kyler, obviously, he raised his hand. He says, I would rather not run a suicide. And it almost gives him, he basically jinxes himself, to be honest with you, because that's what he runs now. So it's an interesting conversation coming from a dude who has experienced quite a bit in a short span. He is just now coming to grips with some of that stuff. And so it's like he said, when he reached out, he's at the beginning of this journey for himself, and he's on a good start. So guys, take a listen. Let me know what you think. Reach out to me. Send me a message, email, whatever you need to do, whatever you want to do. You know, rate the show. I would love for you guys to make some comments and rate the show so we can get more listeners out there. And then, you know, just get outside and take care of yourselves and just go do something for yourselves. A quick reminder to please help us build a community which not only recognizes but supports each other through the struggles and recovery. Reach out through Instagram at The Things We All Carry, or email mystory@thethingsweallcarry.com to offer support and share your story. Please remember to leave a review on iTunes and give a shout out to any first responder you know, love, or care about. Y'all enjoy the show. Let's figure out what we're doing here today and maybe try to have a conversation. Sound good?
Great.
All right, yeah. Well, I'm recording and we're ready to go. So, good afternoon, actually. This is, well, for you, it's morning still, correct, Kyler?
Yeah, I'm still in 11.
Yep. All right. So good morning to Kyler and good afternoon from Virginia, and welcome back to The Things We All Carry. Today I have Kyler, and Kyler's out of central Utah, and he kind of explained it as rural, and we were making jokes because a lot of Utah is that way, but he's out of central Utah. He's been an advanced EMT. He's an advanced EMT with a volunteer fire service and ambulance service, and he runs interfacility transport services, and he's been in the volunteer position as a firefighter for 7 years, roughly 7 years. Did I get that right, Kyler?
Yeah. Yep. You got it. Pretty new to the EMS side of things, going on about a year there, but been doing the fire stuff for about 7 years.
Cool. So welcome. How are you doing?
Good. Yeah.
I know you reached out to me, you know, I forgot if it was on TikTok or Instagram, and you'll have to forgive me if I get that all wrong. Things run together in my head sometimes, and I apologize. And you wanted to come on and just kind of share your story and what you've been dealing with and how, and kind of the changes you want to make, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I reached out on Instagram and, I was really impressed at, you know, you getting back to me. It was awesome. And yeah, just hoping to, kind of talk about what I'm going through and how people can get started.
So before we get down that path, excuse me, let me ask you about the last song you listened to. What was it?
Yeah, so the last song I listened to was In Dreams by Sierra Farrell.
Oh, yeah.
She's a...
Yeah, I know singer. Who she is.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear someone suggest her out there, so that's perfect. She's one of those that some people go, what? And other people that get it go, yeah, all right, I dig it.
Yep.
Yeah, she's very interesting, and her sound is beautiful.
Yeah.
So, and I know I have a buddy of mine up there in Ohio that's cheering that on when he hears it. So there you go, Mark. Someone picks Sierra Farrell for you. All right. So you grew up in Utah. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep. I pretty much my whole life pretty much lived in Utah, up in the West Valley area, which is kind of the hood. Came down to college out here in the middle of nowhere and loved it and stayed.
Where was college?
Snow College in Central Utah.
I don't know that one. All right, cool. Is it a small private school or what is it?
It's not private. It's a state. It's kind of like a community college for everybody that is out in the middle of nowhere.
Okay.
But they only have like 3,000 students. So
yeah, so it's tiny. It's smaller than my high school.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was family life like growing up in Utah?
Yeah, so I grew up in a divorced family, which was kind of an interesting dynamic. My parents were divorced when I was 5, so that was like really the only thing I ever really knew. And half of my house like was super LDS, and the other half was my mom was a rebel, and so she kind of fell away from that. And LDS, for people listening who might not know, LDS is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Most people know him as Mormon.
Yeah, I was gonna make that clarification. Thank you for doing it. So mom was a rebel, and so then the question begs to be asked, which side did you fall on?
Yeah, I ended up, so as a kid growing up, I wanted to be like true blue LDS. Like I was into it. My mom's didn't go to church every single week, but I did, you know, on my own. I would walk myself to church. I was into it. I wanted to be that. But then in life changes and stuff, ended up on the rebel side with all the tattoos and everything. So
was life changes part of growing up and things that happened in your childhood, or does that come later?
A little bit later. Yeah.
Okay. So then mom, you describe mom as a rebel. And from that standpoint of just stepping away from the church, is that what you mean by rebel?
So my mom was like super full of life. She was a people person. She was like one of the most extroverted people I know. In Utah, anybody who drinks and has tattoos is like considered rebellious or out there, you know. And that was my mom. She was a great person, but she was super, super rebellious. And I kind of followed in her footsteps and coming on as a teenager. Part of that, I think.
Yeah, I didn't mean it. I'm sorry to interrupt you. You know what's funny? And you say that if you have tattoos and if you drink, you're kind of, you stand out quite a bit in Utah. And it's funny that you say that, because I saw a highlight of a BYU basketball game the other day, and one of the players had a tattoo, and it took me by surprise, because I was actually surprised that they were allowed to have them on the team.
Yeah, the church. The LDS church has been changing a little bit lately in their stance on some stuff. But when I was growing up, tattoos were huge no-no.
Right. So you grow up, how many siblings do you have? Remind me of the siblings.
Yeah. So I have, I've got two full siblings and then four, half siblings.
And now, I think this is a good time for me to just get out of your way and kind of let you tell the story of growing up and how you find your way into the fire service and all that.
Yeah, for sure. So basically, growing up, you know, I was with my mom, I was with my dad every other weekend, with my mom the rest of the time. My mom got remarried pretty shortly after. I was probably 7 when she got remarried. They got divorced when I was 5. So, you know, 2 years later. And my stepdad was physically abusive towards me. Mm. And that was hard. I always, growing up, I always saw myself as different than everybody else. I was pretty regularly bullied in school. I never fit in. Didn't really have a group of friends or anything. And so it just, that kind of, I think, teed me up for when I was a teenager. I wanted to be different. I was, you know, wanted to kind of start to be rebellious. I still wanted to fall in line with what, you know, what was going on with the church, but I wanted to be different. I guess I wanted to be successful. I wanted to show everybody that had kind of mistreated me, success.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was 18, my mom committed suicide.
Mm.
And that was the the biggest shock, I think, to everybody. Looking back, you can see like bits and pieces of what, you know, resemble some mental health problems for my mom. Every therapist I've talked to said that they probably would have diagnosed her with borderline personality disorder.
Okay.
Just a lot of like emotions at the extreme level all the time. Whatever she was feeling it 100%. And her depression, I didn't really recognize it at the time. Her depression was pretty severe. There were days where we wouldn't see her get up off the couch for 5-6 days. She would just be kind of camped out on the couch, wrapped in blankets, watching Dr. Phil and Oprah for days at a time. And to us, I mean, as kids, that's kind of all we knew. It didn't really, you know, that's just what it was. But I think, so I was kind of on my own at 18. I had a job down here in central Utah to kind of prep to go to college down here, get a living situation sorted out and that kind of thing. So I wasn't actually at home when my mom committed suicide. I was away from home, and I remember still like super vividly the call, getting that call, and somebody said, you know, they said, Kyler, your mom committed suicide. And, I was just like, okay, like, so is she at the hospital or like, what's going on? You know, like, is she at the hospital? What's the deal? And,
was it kind of like,
she's gone.
Yeah, I was gonna say, did you just not believe, you just didn't hear the words and you thought maybe it was just an attempt? Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess in my head, I didn't put two and two together, like committed suicide, attempting to commit suicide. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really had any experience with suicide. So that was like that terminology, like committed suicide, like attempted to, I didn't know the difference, I guess.
Right.
And so that was, and it was such a weird, situation. It was 1 o'clock in the morning when I got that phone call. And it was just like, I was just in like a, like out of body experience, different. Yeah. Like, I didn't know, like, honestly, I sat up for an hour, kind of sitting in a chair, didn't really have, like, I was just disassociated with the whole situation. And then I went back to sleep, like no clue what to do. They didn't really hit me until the next morning that my mom was actually gone.
Yeah. I don't, you know, we both lost our moms much later in life for me, and it was a protracted illness. And so even then I didn't have this feeling that she's actually gone. And so I can only imagine what, as 18 and so sudden, how you try to wrap your mind around it.
I don't know. I don't know. Still, I mean, there are still days where I pick up the phone to call her, you know, like I got stuff I want to say.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know. It's just how it is, I guess. After that, I don't really remember a lot for the next like year and a half of my life from that point forward. I started dating somebody, ended up moving in with that person. I was going to school, getting good grades, working hard. I had a full-time job while I was going to college at that time. And, that was kind of the only, like, I don't really remember feeling with or dealing with that stuff. I do remember trying to go to therapy. But I can say with confidence that I don't think that stuff ever got worked through at that time.
If I remember correctly, one of the things we talked about when we had our initial conversation was the fact that I think you put it along the lines of, if you felt like you were left behind from the other kids had some services handed to them to deal with it, correct?
Yeah. So being 18, so I got, like I said, got a lot of siblings, and a lot of those siblings were, So my dad has two kids with his current wife, and then my two sisters that came from my mom and my dad. And after my mom's suicide, my stepdad really had no interest in continuing to parent my two sisters. And so they ended up moving in with my dad, and my dad is taking on this. He's got two really young kids, like 5 and 1 or whatever they were at the time. And so with my sisters moving in with him and their teenagers, kind of later teenagers, even with suffering this big loss, of course they act out. And so he's got to take all of his attention and kind of focus on them. And I'm out on my own, and just like, I didn't really have a lot of family reach out to me. I think like extended family was still trying to figure out what the heck to do with all of this stuff. And I was just kind of like on my own figuring this out as an adult. And that was kind of the frame I had to look through to get through. It was just like, I'm on my own. Like, I got to figure this out on my own.
Yeah. Which we call 18-year-olds adults, but the reality is we're not adults at 18.
Oh, no. I was the dumbest person I know at 18 years old.
Yeah, you and me alike, my man. You and me alike. So you don't remember the next year and a half or so. And I get that. You're kind of living a fog at that point, correct?
Yeah. It was just like one day to the next, really. Like just trying to get through each day and stay afloat.
How do you start coming out of that?
Yeah, so I don't think like time doesn't heal anything. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I don't believe that at all. But I think at a certain point, maybe we stop thinking about it less, or we start thinking about it less, and we eventually are able to have different thoughts. And that's kind of where I was at when I'm turning like 19, turning 20. I got a different job. I was working in Central Utah, and this is kind of give away my location a little bit, but I was working at a turkey factory in Central Utah.
Okay.
Which is, for anybody looking to do that, don't.
I was going
to
say, that sounds miserable, dude. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was rough. So that was my job. I was working at a turkey factory and ended up shifting to work at an auto shop. Thought maybe that was kind of something I could go into, was like mechanical engineering or automotive design. Right. I started working at an auto shop, and I met a guy, and he invited me to go join the fire department, go to one of the trainings. They're tiny, tiny town. Fire department, like 1,200 people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go to this, and I was hooked, man. This department knew how to set people up to get hooked instantly. The very first training, which I don't know how kosher this is, but very first training, they'll let you drive the fire truck.
Just straight off the street?
What's that?
Just straight off the street?
Yeah. So they're kind of on a dirt road. They'll take you up somewhere kind of on a dirt road and let you drive it for a little bit, play with the lights and sirens.
Yeah. They know what they're doing.
Yeah. And so instantly I was like, oh man, this is like, I want to do this thing. And so I was dedicated member after that. I was showed up to every single training, running through turnout drills. And shortly after started Fire 1, Fire 2. Got through that, ran with them. And like I said, they're probably 3-4 calls a year. Not a lot.
Right.
So the fire side of things, I never really saw anything bad. Like it was just shed fires or wildland fires at most.
Yeah, it's hard to see much that's, you know, traumatic when you run 3-4 calls a year, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You're not going to see anything really. After I graduated from college, I got my bachelor's in science and realized that my current marriage wasn't really working out for me. Getting married at 19, 20 years old wasn't really the thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, went through a divorce, and in going through the divorce, I had this like, first I had to move out because we were living with her parents. So I ended up moving to a different town, the town where the college was, and ended up running with them. And they run a lot more calls, but they're not super interesting calls for the most part, fire alarms and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so that kind of changed a little bit there. We were running about 90 calls a year. And I kind of went through this like reimagining myself. And at that point I decided that I was done. I didn't want to be a member of the church anymore.
How does that work? You know, is that something you just step away from?
So you can. That's how I did it. I just stepped away from it, and they would consider me, like, documentation wise, I would be considered inactive, is the technical term.
Right.
You can do like an official like withdrawal of records from the church and say like, don't ever contact me again, withdraw my records. Which kind of undoes all of their ordinances. They kind of undoes like your baptism. It undoes that. And if you've gone through their temple, it undoes that. So if you ever want to come back, you have to redo those things with them.
Okay. So is there,
I had only ever been,
is there, and this is just sheer curiosity on my part. Is there a reason not to do that? Or is it just easier to go, you know what? I'm just going to slide away right now.
It's easier to, that was my, like, I was totally out, and I had posted that online that I was totally out and had been like, kind of like shunned by a lot of my family, my extended family. But it was, you had to get it notarized if you wanted to like officially withdraw your records.
Okay.
And that was enough for me to like, I don't really care enough to do that.
All right. Yeah. That was just pure curiosity on my part. So.
Yeah. My wife did that. She did the full withdrawal thing, and it's been the same experience for both of us. Like neither of us have really had any contact with the church since. So it doesn't really make a difference, I think, to a lot of people.
Right. Makes sense.
So while running, I met my best friend on Tinder. So we dated, we were engaged for a little bit, and then we both realized like this relationship is not, we're not good at being in a relationship together, but we make really good friends. And so both of us kind of, she was working a desk job, and I said, well, you should come run on the fire department with me. And so she ran with the fire department. I ran with the fire department. And then after we separated, she kind of went into the EMS side of things. Mm-hmm. And I was on fire for a little bit. And at one point she basically twisted my arm and said, you need to get your EMS done. And so, I went, and they had this program with COVID where you could go for free. So I went and got my EMT done for free. And that was, I thought I would hate EMT stuff. I think a lot of people do. I thought, you know what? No, I always want to be running into burning buildings. Like I do not want to be on the box all the time. And I was hooked. As soon as I started running medical calls, I was hooked. It's like this puzzle. Every patient's a little puzzle that you have to try to put together. And that just like with my ADHD, that just tickles my brain the right way.
That makes complete sense to me. You know, I get it.
Yeah, it was good. And so I, when I was doing my EMT, I did like clinicals with an agency in a different town. there was some like small town drama between me and the ambulance agency in the town where I was running fire. And so I started running with an agency in a little bit different town. And I felt like I really grew a family there with them, because it's these people, we see them all the time. We see like if you're not in a full-time fire service, most of the time you're not hanging out with the people that you're running with as that often. Like 90 calls a year is not, you're not seeing people very often. And so these people I was seeing three times a day.
Mm-hmm.
They do interfacility transports. And so I was like, we would be together on a box for 4 hours at a time.
Right.
And so you really do, like, you either love them or hate them, but it's a family relationship.
Yeah.
You know, there's some sibling stuff going on there. Like it's not perfect, but it's definitely a family. You really grow with these people.
Yeah. I think that's kind of a good way to sum it up for many departments, right? You either, you suffer the time you're with them, or you learn to grow with them and you become close no matter what, or sometimes you just connect right off the bat.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's people on this department. There's people that I think I'll probably be friends with for the rest of my life. And there's people that I, you know, that I really like. And there's some people that I don't get along with as much, but luckily those people are a lot fewer and farther between than the people that I really enjoy.
Yeah. That's I think is the experience of a lot of people.
So I remember sitting in my EMT class just prior to getting certified, we were talking about calls, kind of the 45 minute lecture you get on mental health for first responders in your EMT class.
Yeah.
And the question came up with what kind of calls are you worried about? What kind of calls do you not want to go on? And my answer, I didn't even have to think about it, was suicides.
Mm-hmm.
I, without a doubt, did not want to go on any suicides. I didn't know if I could handle it. And everybody at the time, I didn't have any kids. So everybody in the room pretty much had kids, and their answer was pediatric calls. They didn't seem at the time, like, because I didn't have a close association with any kids, that didn't really seem like it would bug me as much.
Right.
But the suicides, I was like, I do not want to see any of those. And I'm a scanner nerd or a radio nerd, whatever you want to call mm-hmm. it. But I hadn't really heard any suicides in my time running fire. Like, it really hadn't been a thing that I had heard, very much at all. And so I wasn't super worried about it. But I knew that was the kind of call I didn't want to go on, and the kind of call that would probably mess me up.
Understandably so, even. I mean, it's way too close and personal to home for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had kind of the foresight, I think, to know that, but I don't think it really hit me as to how common they are.
Mm-hmm. I don't think, like you said, you had a 45-minute bit in your EMT class about mental health for EMT, and they don't want you to know some of that stuff, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, and I don't know. I think in our area, maybe they were not as common, but they definitely have become mm-hmm. common. So after getting licensed as an EMT, within 2 months of starting to run with this agency and getting licensed, I saw my very first suicide. And I can, like, clear as day recall everything about this, everything about these suicide calls. They are definitely my trauma calls. I remember sitting, I run while I'm at work. My work kind of gives me the grace to leave if I have to for mm-hmm. calls. And I'm sitting at my desk and my pager goes off for, you know, 40 something male GSW to the head.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I felt my heart drop like right through my foot. I knew that this was like gonna suck.
Mm-hmm.
And it did. It was a rough call. Not only was it my first suicide call, it was also my first like this person's gonna die call.
Mm-hmm.
Too. Hadn't had really any major like traumas that were, I knew this person's like not going to make it. But one thing without getting too graphic or too into it, one of the things that happened was I went home and I cleaned brain matter off my boot. And I remember like, I thought I got everything at the hospital after we dropped the patient off, went home, take my boots off and realize like I've got this dude's brain on my boot that I've got to clean off.
Yeah. There's no fun way to do that.
Yeah. I mean, there's just like, I was in total shock. And in talking with the people on my ambulance association, pretty much every single one of the people that I talked to said, unfortunately, you just dealt with a 1 in 5 year call. And that's going to be your experience. We get one of those every 2 to 5 years max. And you, unfortunately, in the very beginning of your situation, you got it. Learn how to cope with it. Learn how to deal with it. And you'll be good. The next one will come around when you're super seasoned.
So learn how to cope with it, learn how to deal with it, but they don't offer you tools to learn how to cope with it or deal with it.
And I don't think that's their fault at all. Like, this is not administration. Like, this is my friends on the box, you know,
right,
that are saying this, but I don't think that they knew how to cope with it either.
Well, but that's a fail. Yeah. But that goes back to your administration. It's still a failure on administration at that point, because no one's giving you the tools to do it. Correct.
Yeah, I think it's just like a thing we don't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just the stuff we take home with us that we don't talk about. And I had a conversation with my dad the other day, and he said, when I was growing up, we just sacked up and dealt with it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's a generational thing. I don't know what is going on. Like, not that people from my generation don't try to do that, but how do you sack up and deal with that? You know?
Yeah.
Like, there is not a way that I can conceive to just deal with it. So after that, I thought, all right, I've had my one bad call. Hmm. You know, this is my one call, and I'm gonna learn how to deal with it, and I'm gonna get over it, and then I'm gonna be fine, and then I'm gonna keep running. No more than 3 months after that suicide, we had another suicide, and this was another gunshot wound to the head. But this one was very personal, very different for me. This was an 18-year-old woman, and she had a 4-month-old baby in the house at the time she committed suicide. And this was just so planned, so put together, that there was no denying that this had been something she had been thinking about for a long time. She had placed the baby by the front door in a carrier, and had a diaper bag packed with everything that whoever was taking the baby would need to take care of the baby. And then she left the baby there, went in the bathroom, lay down in the bathtub, and shot herself in the head.
Hmm.
And I guess I should say also, with both of these calls, these people with gunshot wounds to the head, people typically are aiming pretty high up in their brain. And so they lose their, you know, they lose their motor function, they lose their thinking capacity and that kind of thing, but they will still remain alive for usually like 30 to 45 minutes after they pulled the trigger. So breathing, pulse for 30 to 45 minutes. And so these people have to be treated like they have a possibility to survive. You know, they're still alive and they need to be treated, managed, and taken to the hospital, which puts a lot of pressure on the first responder. I think every single time I've gone through this, my brain somehow goes to this place of maybe they'll make it. If I do everything right, maybe they'll make it, even though I know that's not going to happen.
Right. That's such a lofty goal or expectation to put on yourself when you know it can't happen.
Yeah. And when you hear 18 years old and you see this patient, 18-year-old person, you just like, I don't know anybody that could look at that situation and not do everything they could to try and put some amount of emotional investment in having them living.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what I did to myself. I said, maybe if we do everything right, you know, it's not going to regain like total cognition, but maybe if we really put, maybe she'll have some semblance of life after this. And so we got on scene and a police officer was doing CPR, but not very well. And so we pulled patient out of the bathtub and assessed, and she had a pulse. She was breathing. And so we're like, all right, here we go. Let's do this. And so we did. Did everything we could, got the patient to the hospital. Within 15, 20 minutes of arriving to the hospital, patient passed.
Yeah.
Which, that was devastating. I think about, just from like that baby's perspective, like, I don't know what that mom was going through. I don't know how hard her life was. It must've been hell. But that baby is going to wake up a lot of nights and wonder why. And nobody's going to have answers.
No, unfortunately, nobody will have the answer.
And I think that plays back into a lot of like what I ask myself with my mom. Why? So on the home front, after these calls, had a couple cries and thought, you know what? I'm good. I'm processing this stuff. I'm okay. Everything's fine. I'm dealing with this stuff. I'm okay. And it took my wife finally like telling me, dude, you're an asshole at home. Like you suck. Like you are not who you used to be.
Right.
And, that was a wake up call for me to realize like, okay, maybe everything's not okay. And, I tried really hard to, you know, read some self-help books, journal, talk to a couple people and see maybe, you know, maybe that will be enough to fix this. At the time, we didn't have super great insurance, and so that was kind of a barrier to entry with therapy and medications and stuff. It got to the point where I would, anytime I was at home relaxing, I would look down at my smartwatch and see that my heart rate was like 110, 130, and I could feel like tension in my chest. I could feel pressure from the anxiety that I was experiencing. And when I was on calls, I was good because I knew that what was in front of me was the thing that I currently had to deal with.
Right.
It was not, you know, I'm dealing with this call right now. We're on this call. They can't page me out for another call. So I'm just going to deal with this one and everything's good. And, you know, with ADHD, had the little dopamine hit I needed from the call and everything was good. But when I was at home waiting for the pager to go off, I didn't know how to cope with the fact that my next call could be another suicide, which ultimately was the thought that I was always having.
Yeah, these guys had told you that this is a once in a lifetime, once in a career call, right? And then you get two within a couple of months.
Yeah. And I don't know if we're having an epidemic here in my area. But in my agency, we have had four within the last 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's definitely something going on that is, I think there's some real issues. People are really not getting the help they need. But we have had four. So those were my first two. And then, a month and a half ago, we had another one, same deal, gunshot wound to the head. This guy was 40-ish, similar situation, different age, but, same thing.
Yeah. It's I have to imagine you start to ask yourself, am I cursed in this job? Is this what I'm going to see all the time now?
Yeah, it felt like it. It certainly some days still feels like, I don't know, like, why does all this stuff keep, like, why is this happening? Like, why are so many people doing this? After realizing, I guess for me, after realizing that I was having these anxiety attacks or whatever label you want to put on them.
Right.
After I realized I was having these, that I wasn't doing well at home. I wasn't the person I wanted to look in the mirror and see anymore. I finally decided I couldn't do this. Like, couldn't do this on my own anymore.
Hey guys, quick break right here just to check in and thank each of you for listening to the show. Your support has been paramount and I appreciate all of you. I have one request though. I need you to share the show with everyone you know. Help me get the word out and spread these stories as far and as wide as we can. While you're at it, please leave a review of the show wherever you happen to listen. Feel free to reach out to me at any time to share your story, to talk, or to pass on suggestions. Let's get on with the rest of the show.
Well, I'll contribute a lot of realizing that it's okay for me to, like, reach out and get help to your podcast. Like, in going through this stuff, I was like, what do I do? Like, what do I do? How do I even go about doing this? And listening to people who had gone through traumatic stuff like this, come out on the other side, maybe didn't give me the exact path of what I needed to do, but showed me that if I worked at it, there was another side. There was an after all this stuff that I was going through.
Yeah, that's the important part. There's a way to work with it to process and deal with it and come out strong on the other end. So what choice did you make there? Where did you go? What did you turn to and what does it look like?
Yeah. So the very first thing that I realized is, like, I got to get this anxiety under control. Like, mm-hmm. I cannot be 27 years old and having chest pain. Like, this is a, right. Like, this is a problem. So my very first call was to, try to find a psychiatrist. I have been on anxiety depression medications in the past. But every doctor I went to was just like a general practitioner, like a family medicine doctor. And they would just slap me on some different name brand SSRI.
Yeah.
And I had zero luck with those. Like, I don't know if it's because of the ADHD mixed in there or what the deal was, but none of those seemed to work for me at all.
I don't think you're alone there, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it was really discouraging. I like, I was like, I, it was kind of like a Hail Mary for me. Like I need an anxiety med and I need it to work because I can't keep functioning like this. And I, it's pretty much what I told the psychiatrist when I sat down, I was like, I'm not going to keep functioning at this level with this anxiety. It's not going to work for me. That psychiatrist, I really felt like actually listened to what I had to say and put me on a put me on two medications that I actually feel like have been really successful with, which if these two medications hadn't worked, I really don't know where I would be at right now. Like, I was at the end of my rope, I think, with the anxiety. They put me on propranolol, which is a actually like a was designed to be a blood blood pressure slash heart medication, and that has been amazing. She said, you know, initially she's like, "Do it as needed." I don't think I could get through the day without it.
Right.
And so I'm just taking it first thing in the morning every day. And then the other one is Buspirone, which I think is also Buspar. I have also seen that one used for like opiate addiction.
Okay.
Which is kind of, it's kind of an interesting med, but I feel like if you have been through a couple GPs and you're not getting anywhere, my first advice would be like, save up the money, do whatever you have to do to go see a real psychiatrist, because they really, at least this one, had a pulse on what actually is going on with me instead of just prescribing me a different depression med.
Right. And so,
and then,
oh, I'm sorry. Go for it. No, you're good. Go.
I was going to say, and then, I told this psychiatrist, I said, and I also need to get in with, like a trauma therapist, because that was one of my biggest takeaways from the people I've listened to on the podcast is, if you're going to see a therapist for this kind of stuff, it needs to be a trauma therapist. It needs to be somebody who can sit down with you in these level of incidents and actually deal with that with you instead of saying, yeah, this is a little above my pay grade. Maybe you should go see somebody else.
Right.
And, so I met with somebody and because of where I'm at, I'm in the middle of nowhere. There's not my two options that I had kind of considered after listening to a bunch of research on it was EMDR or ketamine based trauma therapy. And because of where I'm at in the middle of nowhere, I thought I'm going to give EMDR a fair shot and they can do that one telehealth.
Right.
So we're going to try that and see how that goes. I've done three sessions of EMDR and my opinions on it is it's not what I thought it was going to be.
Okay.
I don't know why, but I had some like thought in my mind that this was just going to like unlock my brain.
Right.
And like, I was going to have some transcendental experience and it has not been that at all. But I was able to talk through a lower level call, an infant death we had. And I don't really think about that call anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to a lot.
Do you think that with EMDR, if you had EMDR in your toolbox, and that's such an overused term, but you had it in your toolbox when you had your first suicide call and you had gone the next day and you kind of worked through it with EMDR, do you think that would have been helpful or have you even approached those calls with EMDR yet?
We have not approached suicides with EMDR yet. But I do think that knowing about it and having access to it would have probably made a pretty big difference in letting things get as bad as they got.
Yeah. And I think the important thing here to stress is that just because one person on this show, you know, preaches EMDR and thought it was a miracle for them doesn't mean it's a miracle for everybody. It's that just like your experiences are personal, your treatment's going to be very personal.
Yeah. And I don't want anybody to think that I'm saying that EMDR doesn't work. Like, I think it's working, but I don't think it is what I expected it to be.
That makes sense.
Like, I think,
yeah.
Yeah. I think it's working, but in a much more, mundane or ordinary way than I thought it was going to.
Yeah. It's not the overnight miracle cure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it just kind of allows you to process a little bit. It allows you to process things in small chunks,
mm-hmm.
and it allows you to have a second to debrief in between those chunks and defocus, try to think about something, or not try to, but makes your brain go to a different place in between.
Yeah. I want to go back to the medication a little bit because.
Sure.
You said that before the medication, you would come home and it would be those moments of time where you knew that you were calm. The things around you were calm, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you would sit down on the couch and your heart would just race.
Yep.
And yeah, you ruled out, and I want the audience to know, you ruled out anything other than anything organic was ruled out. So there was nothing wrong with your heart. There was nothing wrong physically with you, but you could not find yourself relaxing in that calm. And so,
yeah, it was torture.
Yeah. Describe. I think you described it really well when we first spoke about it. You described that first day when you took it and you came and you sat down and kind of how that literally felt to you. You know, to find out that, wait a second, you know what I'm saying? You remember, that conversation we had?
Yeah. So the very first day that as soon as I finished my therapy call my psychiatry call, she wrote the prescriptions. My wife ran and picked them up while I was at work. And, I took propranolol and I sat on the couch, and it wasn't that I wasn't anxious, but, I was just kind of like, oh my God, like I can actually sit here and I can actually watch a TV show without feeling like I'm going to die. Like, because all of these situations, every time I would sit on the couch to try to just for 1 second, just like relax a little bit. And I'm like, those situations to try to relax did not come often to me. Like I'm running usually like 40 hours on the ambulance, and I'm working 40 hours a week at my day job. So like, and a little bit of that overlaps, but I'm easily working 70 hours a week.
Right.
And so the chance for me to actually sit down and just relax, like, does not happen. And when I was doing that before the medication, it was worse. Like I wanted to be somewhere else, anywhere else, working on something, just not thinking about trying to relax. Because the second that I tried to do that, I was in literal hell all the time. And the first time I took the medication, and after about 2 hours of it setting in, I could actually sit down and I could actually watch a TV show with my family without feeling like I was in hell or I was going to die.
Yeah. And like, I know when you talked to me about it the first time, it was just, it blew you away. It amazed you.
Yeah, it felt like a miracle drug.
Yeah.
Like it was one of the best things that's happened in my recent life.
Have there been any downsides to the medication for you at all?
No. I'm tired. I'm a little sleepy.
Okay.
Sometimes.
You're just sleepy after taking it, or just all, or just in general?
It's a little harder to wake up in the morning. Okay. And, sometimes I'm not as like hyperactive, I guess, which is probably a benefit for most people, with ADHD, but I would say no major side effects.
Okay. Yeah. And that was just out of curiosity, because I'm not familiar with it at all. You know, the first time I heard it used in this situation is when you and I spoke about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not super common, but it's been.
What's been life changing for
you? It's probably going to not work for everybody, but.
So EMDR three times now on top of the medication. Anything else you've added to your repertoire of self-care?
Yeah, journaling has been a big one. And now that I'm actually able to relax, not taking OT as much as I was.
Yeah. That's a big key right there, isn't it?
Has been big. So taking, what's that? Sorry.
That's big right there. Not taking as much OT. I broke up on your end, didn't I?
Yeah, I did. You're good now. I can hear you.
I said, that's kind of key right there, is that not taking as much OT.
Yeah, that's pretty big. I think I looked at the box with the anxiety I was undergoing. Like, I looked at the box as a way to not be sitting on my couch, like living through hell.
It's a different way to avoid.
Whenever I could pick up. Yeah. Yeah. Whenever I could, I would just pick it up and avoid having to deal with that stuff.
It makes a huge difference when you're not consuming your time with work just to avoid avoid those situations that you were in, the heart racing, the anxiety, whatever your experience is. Other people pick up OT to avoid other things. And it's a common practice in our line of work.
Yeah. And I think I've heard a lot of times people say like, don't take OT. You're going to get burned out. But I think we do it to try to fix something that we're not dealing with. And I think the real thing, I mean, obviously don't take OT, you'll burn yourself out, but we really need to be seconding that up with also deal with the shit you're not dealing with at home.
Yeah. Yeah. Avoiding OT is one thing, but actually fixing the issues that you're ignoring is the more positive step that everyone needs to take.
Yeah.
So,
and then kind of my,
go ahead. Yep.
My other thing that, I've realized in doing the therapy stuff is like my biggest thing is with all of these calls is working to just kind of accept that there's a lot of stuff that I'm powerless in. Yeah. And I need to be okay with that.
Yeah. So what does that look like for you when you say that?
We tell ourselves all the time in EMS, there's nothing I could have done. I did everything I could do. And I'm kind of trying to change that a little bit in my life to say, like, nothing could be done.
Hmm. So what you're saying is I brought to this call, nothing was going to be able to be done. It's nothing I did. It's nothing anyone could have done, because nobody could have done it.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, with all these suicides, we could have 15 trauma surgeons.
Yeah.
Like the second the trigger was pulled there and nothing would have happened. It wouldn't have changed anything. Nothing could be done. And furthermore on that too, like, blame myself a lot for like, well, if I would have known, or if somebody had known before the trigger was pulled, they could have stopped this. And I think we should always be working in our lives to try to reach out to people and maintain contact with people and be good people.
Mm-hmm.
But these people made a decision for themselves long before anybody could have done anything. And when you finally learn, if you ever get the chance to know before, I mean, everybody's going to do everything they can to try to stop it. But these people, the people that really want to commit suicide, are not showing any of that to anybody. They are keeping all of that inside. They do not want people to know because they have decided that they're done.
Yeah.
It's not a cry for help. None of these were a cry for help. They did not want help. They wanted to be gone. And so saying that, you know, saying to myself that there is nothing that could have been done. Take some of that anger away from why didn't somebody know? Why didn't somebody do something?
Have you been able to apply that in your own situation with your own mom?
No. No, I still.
But why not?
My mom is still something that I really need to work through.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. I'm just curious if that, because it's a very common sense thing you said, right? The people that you've run these calls on have got to a point where they're determined to end their life, right? And I've seen a number of suicides where I look at the scene and I go, fuck, there was nothing that was going to talk this person out of it. And I don't want to glorify any of the things that I've seen, but I can sit with a certain crew of mine and talk about the woman that we found that had hanged herself from the closet door, not the top of the door, but the handle of the door. So that meant she sat down and hung herself when all she had to do was stand up and live, but she was determined and no one was going to talk her out of that. You know, I mean, someone could have physically intervened, sure, but she wasn't going to tell anybody. So that's, I'm just curious if you've thought about trying to align your thoughts with your mom about it with the same way and kind of give the same grace to yourself.
Yeah, that one's, I need to, and I know that I need to do that. I know that, but I think, I don't know. I think with these situations, the longer we let them go, the more callous. Like we build up things around them to stop ourselves from thinking about them as like a defense mechanism. And I need to break through those and think about it. But anytime I get close to it, I don't want to.
Of course you don't want to. No. I don't blame you. Of course you don't want to. It's completely understandable. And it's something that you'll need to do and probably with somebody with you that's equipped to kind of run you through it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it was just an interesting question that popped in my head. So hopefully you don't mind me asking that. And I apologize if I stepped on your toes.
No, for sure. No. Yeah. That's a great question. Yeah.
So then what do you do? Go ahead. I keep stepping, man. I'm screwing this up. I'm going to edit some of this to my mistakes out. So I apologize.
No, you're good. I think my takeaway from this whole thing is like, initially after the first suicide, I knew it messed me up. I didn't want to admit it. I wanted to like skate around it and eventually hope that it would go away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a big part of that was me thinking that, and I think a lot of other people see it this way too, is like, you haven't seen shit. Like, you don't know anything. You don't know what, you know, you don't know what other first responders go through.
Right.
Like you're making this out worse to be in your own head than it actually is. And, I think my first thoughts on all this stuff is like, if you think maybe, then get help.
Yeah. Yeah. If there's
process this stuff before it gets worse.
Yeah. If there's an inkling where you sit there and you go, I could do this.
Yeah.
So what do you do differently today? How do you approach life differently today?
I think, so I'm reading a book. I can't remember the name of it. It's like Growth Through Trauma. Mm-hmm. It's something along those lines. Post-traumatic growth.
Oh, yeah.
I think the name of the book.
Yeah.
And I think my biggest takeaway from haven't seen all the stuff that I've seen is that I am grateful every morning to wake up. And that sounds cheesy, you know, but I really am. Every single morning that I wake up, that I get another day with people that I love and care about. I try to embrace that as much as I can. And try and with all the regular stress that we have in daily life, I try to realign, to focus on the fact that I get another day to do EMS, to do the stuff that I love, and to be with the people that I really care about.
Mm-hmm. And so you'll continue the medication. Continue some therapy. You've got more EMDR planned, or do you think that that's not on the horizon for you?
I got one tomorrow. Yeah. Okay. I think I'm going to keep trying it.
All right.
I really do think it worked with the one scene that we talked about. I feel like I don't think about that anymore. Kind of to the point that I'm not real, the details are becoming more fuzzy to me.
Okay.
Like that I've processed that, and maybe I don't have space to hold that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful for that. I think, I'm going to keep trying it. If at any point I really don't feel like it's working, I'm going to find a way to do the ketamine therapy and try that and see if that works as well. But I think, you know, the medication has improved not only my outlook on life, but, also like my wife's outlook on me. She's kind of made the comment that you're home a lot more and you're happier when you're here. And that's been a blessing for me too, because I don't want my family to hate when I'm around.
Yeah. That would help, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
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 Makes home life a lot easier.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I can sit at home and play with my daughter and actually enjoy it and not be terrified of what's going to come next or anxious about what might happen. Just enjoy the moment.
So you're 7 years into this journey, this fire EMS journey, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You get the chance to sit down in front of a room of rookies and they have no idea what's facing them. Well, give me three things you might tell them.
The first is that it doesn't matter what agency you work at. You might think you're going to skirt free of this stuff. You're not. You will have shit calls and you are going to be affected by them, and you're going to take that stuff home with you and you're going to think that you don't need to deal with it. Like we all do. We're all, you know, as people say, alpha personalities. We all think we're better than this. We all don't think we need to deal with it. You do need to deal with it. And there will come a point where you have to choose to deal with it.
All right.
That would be the first thing I would say is you are going to be affected by it.
Yep.
I think I would also say that if you look around at people on the agencies you go to work with, and you see people who are salty, that are assholes to people and are rude to patients, those are the people that are not dealing with it. When we choose to deal with this stuff and we deal with it in the right way and we get the help that we need, it allows us to perform better at our jobs. And it doesn't make us worse because we have bad feelings and we go get help and we seek help. Doesn't make us worse first responders. It doesn't make us pansies. It doesn't make us weak people. It doesn't make us less of a man or woman or mm-hmm. they, them, you know, it doesn't make us any less. It makes us better. It allows us to hold more compassion and empathy for patients, for people, for coworkers in general. Dealing with this stuff it changes, and our families first and foremost, it changes our ability to hold compassion and to be there for our families. And probably the third thing I would say is it's okay to love running on the box, but don't forget mm-hmm. what you've got going on at home.
You know, that's huge. And that's funny, because I had a therapy session yesterday and we talked about, you know, me leaving the fire service. And I said, the one thing I realized is, and it's insidious because it happens to just about everybody. And I preach about it too. And I say, hey, don't let this become your identity. Don't get so wrapped up in fire service that you ignore the outside world. And you know, I realize that I'm guilty of that myself, you know, and it's just too easy to do. You know, the schedule lends itself to losing contact with the outside world, so to speak.
Yeah, I think it's hard because at least for me, when I got into this, like, I wanted this to be my identity. Like, I wanted to be a firefighter. I wanted to be an EMT. Like I wanted to change the world. I wanted to be somebody that people look up to. And, you know, I don't think any of that stuff in and of itself is bad. The problem is when you stop being who you are, mm-hmm. to be this job, and you know, because part of who you are is what got you into this job. But if you leave the rest of yourself behind, you're going to lose a lot of what makes you, you. And a lot of that is the compassion that you have for other people, I think.
Yeah, I think that's well said, actually. So where do you think, where are you today? How would you describe yourself today?
Putting in the work.
Okay. And that means putting in the work on you as a person?
Yeah. I think, I can't think of anybody I know that's like, I'm amped up to go to therapy today. I am so ready to talk to my therapist. And maybe there will come a time for me that I feel that way. But I have never had a therapy session where I'm like, let's do this thing.
Dude, if you get a chance, listen to my intro from the show I released today, because I was worn out yesterday by the time it came around to record on my intro. And I described it as a 12 round championship fight. You know, it's, you come out bruised and battered, you know?
Yeah. I don't think anybody wants to go to therapy. I think that might be part of the apprehension for starting it.
Yeah.
It's like, that doesn't sound fun or exciting talking about stuff. That's like a lot of first responders, you know, like me, have ADHD, and that is not the thing they want to do. Sit down and talk to somebody for an hour.
Right.
But I think that is a thing that we should all be doing.
Yeah.
You know, I think everybody has some stuff that they, and I'm not recommending that everybody should be on lifelong therapy, but I think if you're a year into this job, you probably have some stuff you need to talk about.
You know, I don't think you need lifelong therapy, like lifelong weekly sessions or whatever. I think that therapy ebbs and flows. The need for therapy ebbs and flows. You're going to have times where you can go months without having therapy, and then you're going to say, hey, I need to go check in. And then like I did yesterday, I went and I kind of checked in, but then when I got there, I realized, no, I need to do this a couple more times in close proximity to each other, just because I have some things to work out. And I think there's a trap to fall into once you get to a position in some therapy that you think, oh, I got this. And you do, to an extent, but it's like the old saying, you got it until you don't.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think too, with medications, people get that way, which drives me nuts. Like, I've seen it in my family. People are like, oh, I'm off my psych meds, I'm feeling better now. It's like, you probably were feeling better because you were on them.
Right. Yeah. It's an amazing concept, right? So where do you think you're going in the future? What are your goals in the future?
My biggest goal right now is to try to advocate for people to get help. I think Utah has like the worst mental health in probably the United States. Nothing against people who pray or have, you know, a God or anything like that. Like, I think that's a powerful resource to have. But every single person I've talked to says like, oh, well, you know, I don't need therapy. I've got God, you know, he helps me through all of this stuff that I'm going through. And coincidentally, Utah has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation as well. And so I'm really trying to push hard to make these resources more available to people. I don't know if you've heard of this before. Utah actually signed a bill into law that requires agencies to provide continuing mental health resources for their first responders. And trying to get that into agencies in my area has been a nightmare.
Despite the fact it's signed into law.
Correct. Yeah. Nobody wants to pay for it.
Right. Exactly.
And I have never, you know, I've never said to anybody, listen, man, I've like put so much money like out of my own pocket to go get the help that I needed. And cost was a big barrier to me actually doing that. But in lieu of saying that, I have tried to express how important mental health resources are for first responders to have access to and to have availability. And then alongside that, I want to get certified in Utah. You can get certified as a peer support group person. And so that's kind of, I listened to one of your podcasts on the peer support group, and that's one of the things I think would be really important to get started in my area as well.
I like it. I like both of them. Those are two solid things to kind of look to the future for.
Yeah.
So let's get to those last two questions of mine.
Sure.
When is the last time you felt a sense of awe? Something that you've just sat back and going, wow, fuck, that is, you know, like, it's just amazing.
So I didn't have a moment when we kind of talked about this last time, but I had probably the best experience I've had so far in my life. So my wife is 13 weeks along with twins.
Oh man, your life is going to change.
It is going to be insane. We got one 5-year old that we have 50% of the time, but we're about to have two 100%.
Yeah.
But we knew about the twins last time we talked, but the first ultrasound is pretty boring.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not a lot going on in there. You see two little dots and you know, okay, there's two kids in there. But this last time we went in there, they did the ultrasound probe and I can see this little kid in there kicking around.
Yeah.
Like just kicking and trying to move and, you know, has like, they showed us, oh, here's the fingers. You can see there's five fingers on this hand. And I'm just like, that is the coolest thing.
Yeah, right.
In the whole world. Like they're literally little people right there. And I get to be friends with them in like 5-6 months. And that was just the coolest experience ever.
Very cool. I'm glad you got that. That is amazing. So what about a book? I know you already suggested one. So now we got to come up with a different one.
Give me one second.
Yeah, man. Do your thing.
All right. So for books, I'm a huge, huge podcast listener. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite podcasts, totally different than this one, is The World's Okayest Medic.
Okay.
And he's just kind of, he does a lot of the clinical stuff, but he does it in a way that's really sassy, I guess you would describe it as. But he has a book that's actually the best EMS book that's not a textbook that I've ever read.
Okay.
And it's the Handbook for EMS Providers. And he really breaks down like this is what EMS is. Sometimes EMS is just putting a blanket on somebody who needs to be warm.
Sometimes it is. You're right. And what's
so that's my book recommendation.
So you gave me the podcast name. What's his name? What's the author?
Name is Mike Caruncio.
Okay. Cool. I'll check it out. I'm not doing much EMS anymore now that I'm stepped away from the fire service, but I like the plug, so good job.
It's more for beginners.
Oh, okay. Hey, then it's something I can suggest to people. So either way it works out.
Yeah.
So, hey, I appreciate that conversation. That was fascinating. I appreciate you coming on. Appreciate you being open and being, I can't speak English, being willing to share that with people.
Yeah. Thanks for your podcast and all you do. It really, really does change a lot out there. It's really changing the world of first responders. So,
well, I'm hoping it like changes people one at a time, and I'm happy with that, you know, and we'll shoot for the moon later. How about that?
Deal.
All right, man. Go enjoy the rest of your day out there in Utah and take care of yourself. And you got my number. I'll let you know when this one's coming out, and we'll just start sharing it, and you can do the same. All right.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks. Bye, man.
Take care. And we're out.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Things We All Carry. Head over to the website, thethingsweallcarry.com, for show notes, resources, and to sign up for the newsletter. Until next week, take care of yourselves and remember to check in on each other.